Hello, and welcome to Experto Crede, a podcast where we explore the legal scholarship published annually by the Minnesota Law Review and the experiences of authors, staffers, and editors who put it all together. I'm your host, Lucy Chin, lead online editor for Volume 108, and today I'm joined by three of my MLR colleagues, managing editors Lindsay Maher and Randall Larson, and articles editor Tyler Blackman, for a discussion on the student note writing process. Welcome. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Great.
Excited.
So today we have you all here because you are three of the 3L editors who have notes published in this year's volume of Minnesota Law Review. We're going to talk about the note process and your experience with your pieces. Just by way of quick introduction, Randa published a note in issue 2 entitled Banishing Federal Overstep, Why Protecting Tribal Sovereignty Justifies a Narrow Reading of the Indian Civil Rights Act. Lindsay published a note in issue 3 entitled American Dream, Social Pressures and Lackluster Regulation Allow Multi-Level Marketing Companies to Function as De Facto Pyramid Schemes. And Tyler published a note available in issue 4 entitled The Good, the Bad, and the Unconstitutional, State Attempts to Solve the Defendant Class Action Problem. With that introduction, I'm going to pass it over to you all, and I'm wondering if each of you in turn could start with your own introduction of your note, maybe a bit of background on the topic itself, and how you became interested in the topic in the first place. So, Randall, let's start with you.
Yeah, for sure. So, Randall Larson, managing editor, and my note centers on federal Indian law. So, it's looking at the Indian Civil Rights Act and whether or not banishment constitutes detention under the habeas corpus provision of said act. It's really an interesting, and it's through the lens of like a circuit split. So it's a really interesting dynamic between protecting tribal sovereignty and then also individual tribal members' civil rights. So I look at specifically whether tribes should be able to banish individual tribal members from their ranks without being subject to federal judicial review and scrutiny through the Indian Civil Rights Act. So I don't know what more to say.
That's great. About that. Okay, Tyler?
Sure. So mine is all about civil procedure. So for anyone out there who's a civil procedure nerd, this is for you. So mine looks at what are called defendant class actions. So if you think about class action litigation in this country, the vast, vast majority of them are plaintiff class actions. It's a group of plaintiffs who all get together because they can't really afford their own litigation, and they sue a few defendants. But the federal rules, and as my note shows, most state rules, allow the exact opposite to happen as well. So the sort of example that I like to use is, imagine that Netflix decided it wanted to sue all of its subscribers who were violating password sharing rules that it had come up with via contract, and they classed an entire group of defendants and then tried to sue them all, and then chose the defendant who they wanted to actually see in court, obtain a judgment against them, and then invoice all those folks and make them pay a small bill. That's really what the federal rules allow, technically. And the states have tried to solve all of the problems that come with that. As you can imagine, there are really kind of two big problems that come with allowing defendant class actions. One is sort of an administrability problem. Federal judges and state judges who have had to handle these cases have just had a really difficult time trying to administer these cases. And then there's a lot of due process issues as well. So when the states have come up with their own rules around defendant class actions, a lot of them have tried to fix the problem that is in Rule 23, the federal rule about class actions, by sort of experimenting on how they can change defendant classes. And so I call them the good, the bad, and the unconstitutional. Very long story short, the good being what Maryland has done to get rid of defendant class actions, which is my preferred solution, and keep plaintiff class actions. The bad being throwing out the baby with the bathwater and getting rid of all class actions altogether, which is what Virginia and Mississippi have done. And then what I think is, I always say clearly unconstitutional. Most of my editors always try to get rid of the word clearly because you don't want to say that in a piece like this, but I think is clearly unconstitutional, which is the practice of mandating that people can't opt out of these defendant classes, because even in plaintiff class actions, the Supreme Court has said you have to allow class members to be able to opt out of litigation. And so I think what the defendant class action, or the states who are mandating that these people can't opt out of the class actions, are doing some unconstitutional things. So that's a very long-winded introduction to my piece, but it's kind of a complicated quirk of civil procedure.
Awesome. And Lindsay?
Sure. So my piece, as the title indicates, is focused on multi-level marketing companies, and I have had an interest in the multi-level marketing industry long before I started law school, which is why I chose to write this piece. I think the kind of crux of the whole, my interest was, how are these legal? And that was a question I started with. And so the piece looks at the legal sort of history of the multi-level marketing industry and how it has developed since its really quite long history in the United States, and the really loose legal standards that have been applied to the industry by the FTC, by the like state and federal regulators. And so it looks at all of that and kind of explores how loose those regulations are. And then it also, the piece kind of also focuses on why people actually join MLMs and how that contributes to the problem being so large that so many people are financially injured. So the piece also takes a look at the social pressures that are inherent in a multi-level marketing scheme, which I think, like, very briefly is, they are legally pyramid-structured companies that recruit other people to join, and only about, we'll say, 1 to 10% of people ever make any money off of being a part of one. And so the, but part of that structure involves being a part of a community and recruiting your friends and family to be within the MLM with you. And that makes it really, really hard to leave, because it's not just about your own individual decision. It's about the community that you're now a part of that means something to you more than just a business. So the piece recognizes that there's more to this than just loose legal standards. It's some human nature aspects of why people join these companies, and then talks about some regulations that would be really helpful to put in place on the federal level to help, you know, federal and state regulators actually regulate the companies and be really clear about what is a pyramid scheme and what is a legal multi-level marketing company. And I'm using quotes around that for people who don't watch this video. but the other solution is something that it will be interesting to see. The FTC has a regulation that was passed in 2008 that requires companies that are putting out as a like a business proposition that you are starting your own business. Those kinds of companies have to disclose the financial potential financial impacts for new people who join. And at the time that that law or that regulation was passed, the MLM industry lobbied really hard to not be included in that rule, and they were successful. And so that rule does not encompass multi-level marketing companies. And so the other thing the piece proposes is that that rule be amended to include MLM companies, because at the end of the day, that is what they're doing. They're, you know, selling a product, but they're also selling the opportunity to sell the product. So that is kind of, those are the two suggestions that my piece ends with.
Okay. So these are very diverse issues, all with legal hooks and definitely in the realm of a law review article. But they also touch on pretty broad policy questions, legal questions, from federal Indian law to civil procedure to marketing and business corporations. I'm wondering if each of you can talk about how you narrowed that really broad legal topic into what ultimately became your no topic. That is a challenging process for those of us who have been through it. And so if you can share a little bit about how you ended up putting a point on the note that you ended up producing and that will be published for us. And maybe, Lindsay, we can start with you and go the other direction.
Sure. So in the writing process, I knew I wanted to write about MLMs. I'm sort of like obsessed with them. and so I knew I wanted to write about them, and I knew I wanted to talk about why it is they exist and why they're so prevalent in the United States and honestly around the world, but largely in the United States. And as I was writing, I kept getting feedback from my editors that were like, that more or less they were like, I'm sorry, I don't understand the difference between a pyramid scheme and an MLM. Can you please make it more clear? Can you please make it more clear? And at some point I was like, I think that is actually the point. Like, it's not, there's not a clear delineation, and that is on purpose, you know? And so that kind of, I was able to hone in on what I wanted to talk about as I was researching and as I was writing. And I think in addition to that, I was interested in the behavioral part of it because there's, you know, I guess maybe what you would call a legal realist, like there's just more to life than just like the law. And so I was really interested in talking about why people do the things they do and that it isn't just like a financial incentive. And that is why I chose to make that such a big part of the piece. And I'm, you know, that was the most interesting part to write about, I will say. So I'm glad that I went that route, but that's kind of how I got to where I was with the focus of my piece.
I think a good lesson for listeners is there is more to life than the law. So
that can be the takeaway, the subtitle of the episode.
Title of them.
Yeah.
So sort of similarly, I really like class action litigation. I think I really fell in love with it just in my first year of law school in a very first semester taking civil procedure. That's when we first learned about Rule 23 and sort of how to go through class action litigation. To me, there's just a lot of power in sort of collective power in a bunch of folks being able to stand up together against a corporation. And that is sort of the traditional plaintiff class action litigation that you see out there. And so I did that work my first summer when I was in law school, worked at a plaintiff side class action firm, and want to continue doing that even beyond law school as well. But my 1L summer, I was working at a firm researching a memo on class action litigation and ran across a case that dealt with a defendant class action and described them as, quote, as rare as unicorns. And that quote just really stuck with me. And I sort of tucked that away back in my brain and thought, that's really interesting. Because when you talk about class action litigation in civil procedure, it's always sort of assumed that the plaintiff class is what you're talking about. And it's just a really understudied aspect of class action litigation. So one of the things that editors will tell you when you're writing a note is to just make sure that your contribution to the legal scholarship is novel, right? And that you're not writing about something that plenty of other people have written on. I mean, sort of my go-to example when I'm talking to other people about it is like, unsurprisingly, last year, a lot of people wanted to write about abortion for obvious reasons. And that's great, but it's really difficult to make sort of a unique contribution to the legal scholarship as a student in that very, very large debate. But this one, the defendant class action just seemed, because not many people were writing about it, it seemed like I could actually do something here and have a very kind of unique contribution to the scholarship. So very few people have written about defendant class actions because they are fairly rare. And no one, I think, has written about how states have handled defendant class actions. And so I knew I wanted to sort of critique the entire idea of defendant classes, and I also knew I wanted to sort of look at how states were doing it. And so I kind of tied those two things together to say, okay, there's problems with the federal rule and how much due process they're offering defendants here. And so we've got a natural experiment here with the states. They're trying to solve this problem too. So instead of just trying to very theoretically solve the problem, let's just look at the solutions that have actually been implemented in the states and evaluate them. So that's how I literally read every single state rule and statute about defendant class actions, all 50, and tried to sort of come up with a pattern and categorize them. And so, yeah, I think that's how I ultimately honed in on this particular topic is I knew I wanted to do class action stuff. I knew that this was kind of a rare, interesting thing, and I knew that what I was contributing to the scholarship was unique and interesting. And to be honest, like, I have a background in working in state legislatures, and I could see myself, you know, bringing this piece to state legislators and saying, hey, you have a law on your books that is clearly unconstitutional. You should think about changing it. And here's a very long article as to exactly why.
Unapologetically, clearly, yeah. Unconstitutional.
Again, I keep saying clearly, but I think my editors would disagree with that.
Okay, Randa?
Yeah, similarly, I knew I wanted to do my note on either tribal law or federal Indian law. Personally, that hits home for me. I'm a descendant of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. So Native issues, whether legal or not, are like at the forefront of my personal life. I try to make it at the forefront of my academic life whenever I can. So when you're given the opportunity to like write a note about anything that interests you, I'm gonna do that because, I mean, there aren't a ton of academic opportunities in Indian law, at least at the University of Minnesota. We have a couple great classes, but I really wanted to hone in on something specific where I could like focus on one topic and go really in depth on it and not just get this like general overview of federal Indian law. So I was kind of looking around and I came across a circuit split on the topic of banishment, Indian Civil Rights Act. Circuit splits are weird and kind of tricky because I don't want to get like put in this box, like you have to go this way or this way. But the more I researched it, the more I was like, oh, there's a lot to this. And like Tyler was saying, federal Indian law in legal scholarship is pretty underrepresented and reported. And a lot of it is so, it varies across time. Like what's written today in federal Indian law is so different than was written even like 5 years ago. So it's like constantly evolving. So I figured I could add something in that realm and examine a topic that is not discussed, like banishment. I didn't know that banishment was like a thing that happened, but I know a lot about it now, probably too much. So that's how I kind of narrowed it down. I wanted to learn something new that I didn't know about and just kind of work from there. I mean, examining it through a circuit split was also really interesting because the circuit split is like decades old. One case came up in, I think, the 90s, and then the other case was like 2019 or more recently, and then some other cases, other like circuits are still like discussing it. So yeah. I'm trying to think of what else to say on that. But yeah, I just think that working in federal Indian law is super important. And even if I don't go down that road, like practice wise, I think as long as I could use the note writing process to explore an interest of mine that might not become a career, but like still worth looking into and adding to the legal scholarship on it is really valuable.
If I could just add to, I mean, think like one common theme you'll see throughout all three of our topics is like we found it interesting. And I think that's just like worth highlighting because for so many reasons, I guess two big things I would highlight is one, you're going to spend a lot of time with this piece if you take it from sort of idea stage all the way through publication. I mean, we started working on our note topics a year and a half ago, and we are still working. I'm still about to submit my final piece in a week or two, and that's just a long time to spend with one topic. And so, just for folks who are thinking about trying to choose topics of their own, I would just really emphasize find something that you are so interested in that you want to do it for a year and a half. And frankly, when you go through the publication process as well, that's sort of a criteria as well, right? You want to have something that other people are going to want to read. So even if, you know, think about things that are novel and all of that, but also just interesting.
Yeah. And that was definitely a thread that I was hearing through your all's answers to that question is that notes, which maybe on first glance seem like a term paper or a like academic project, right, actually aren't that at all. It's an opportunity to take something that you've always been really excited or interested in, or that has a very like personal resonance for you, and just explore it from a new perspective. And so it feels exciting that that cut across all of your answers, that you have a lot of freedom and autonomy in the note writing process, and there's some scariness to that, but also a lot of excitement for making something that is, that contributes to legal academia, but also is like a deeply exciting and personal process. On that note about narrowing your topics and ending up at publication a year and a half later, I wonder if you can talk about some of the fun parts of the writing process, some of the challenging parts of the writing process. Is there things that stick out to you as particularly important parts of the year and a half, year plus that you've spent on this note writing endeavor that you would maybe want other folks to know about?
Well, my piece, just like I guess contextually, got published yesterday. And I, you know, when I posted about it, I was like, writing this was a dream and a nightmare. to that end, I think that I felt quite nervous the whole time about making something that people would want to read, and that I was doing good research, and that just I find that kind of to be paralyzing, and I don't think I'm alone in that. And so it's really hard to actually just write stuff, even if it's like bad. You just have to like write stuff down. And so I found that pretty challenging. And I think the other thing I found challenging was letting go of things once I had already written it. And particularly, you know, I got some feedback from like my faculty advisor and some other faculty, and like one of them was like, I think you don't need this like whole section. Like, I think you just cut this. And I was like, what? No, like everything in this is like essential. And I don't think anything I'm saying here is like something that any person who's written something has never felt before. It's not like a unique take, but I do think as someone who's never done it before, you know, so if there's some 1L who just joined a journal who's like, I wonder what a note writing press is like. I think that that happens for most people at some point. It's just you get really attached to what it is you're talking about, and you don't want to, you know, just get creative with it after a while because it feels like you're kind of set in what you want to do. So I found that challenging. I think the research was easier than I thought because we have amazing librarians at the school, and they were really, really helpful in both the legal research and the more like behavioral psychological research that I wanted to do. They found like amazing pieces for me to work from. So that was fun because I mean, I like reading other people's research, especially on this topic, because in the behavioral world, a lot of people are like, what is going on? And have recently been really interested in it. So that was cool to read, and it was fun to put it together. But yeah, certainly people, I think, try to tell you how challenging note writing is, and then you do it. And yeah, it is. It is hard.
I was like nodding vigorously during everything Lindsay was just saying. I'm just like, yeah, it's like, it's such a proud moment to like, especially when it comes to like publication, you're like, wow, I did that. Like I spent a year and a half working on this and now it's like done. So it's kind of hard to let go of it at that stage too. But yeah, I think challenge wise, I found challenges trying to find people to read my paper that, you know, knew federal Indian law and were able to like talk about it. My faculty advisor, amazing, love her. She's so great, but like she's not an expert in federal Indian law. Didn't really know much about the topic, but a fantastic writer, so she was able to help me in so many ways, but I had to go outside of like MLR and outside of Minnesota law in general just to kind of find people and be like, is this like a good topic? Am I saying the right thing? And those conversations are so hard too, because I flip-flopped so much on my just like whole argument. Mm-hmm. Like I would wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, I need to switch everything. Like I think of it totally differently. And then eventually it's like getting that out of your head. You have to pick one. And so that was a challenge for just like the general topic of my note. I had another one. There's so many challenges, like it's hard to like pinpoint a couple, but in general, it's just like being proud of like what you've been able to put on paper, and the amount of people that have like faith in what you're putting on paper is like valuable to legal scholarship, I think, is like really helpful and important and definitely a confidence boost. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you all, but I just still have like a lot of nerves about putting it out into the world. You know, I've done so much work on it for the last year and a half, and you know, it hasn't quite hit published yet, but it's about to. And I don't know, I still have these back of my mind fears that someone out there is gonna be like, you fundamentally misunderstood Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Why didn't you consider this very obvious point?
Clearly unconstitutional.
Yeah, exactly.
Not so clear.
But I do think that's, I mean, I think both of you have talked about this, but it is the value of making sure that it gets in front of other people, and you do have to kind of overcome that pride of authorship. Because I think my instinct is to like not want to show it to other people because I like am afraid they're going to point out a bunch of flaws with it, and you just have to get over that. Because like, for example, I showed one draft of it to a civil procedure professor, and he did point out like a fairly obvious thing that I wasn't considering, and I'm very grateful that he did that before I hit published, because I would have made a, you know, kind of incorrect assumption about how a thing in civil procedure works. And so I would just say for people who are thinking about going through this process, please get over that pride of authorship and make sure that you get it in front of sort of subject matter experts and those sort of things, because they are incredibly helpful. And I will just say too, so I'm an articles editor, and so it means that I spent my 2L year doing a lot of site checking, and then I spent a lot of my sort of end of 2L year, beginning of 3L year, working with other professors on doing edits above the line. And it is strange, frankly, being on the other side of that. And I think I just began to value a lot more that feedback, because you know, we go to school with incredibly smart people, and they all of a sudden are no longer just your peers, but your editors. And just trusting that, like, they can be really invaluable to your writing process. And I think it's, you know, it's just a good lesson for future career as well, to just really rely on your colleagues to put a fresh set of eyes on things and help you improve your writing.
I will add one small thing. At least for me, I had anxiety about people reading it, but I also was very ready to accept all edits from editors, just being like, you know what? Yes, you're right. I'm just going to accept everything. And I think something else that came out of this that is positive and like good for me was to actually be like, you're wrong. Or I don't agree with that. I don't like the way you're phrasing it. Like taking more control and saying like, I do know what I'm talking about, and I don't have to just like accept what like an editor thinks of my writing, even though, you know, majority of it is really helpful and great. But there are some things where, as the author, I was like, oh, well, this is why when professors get annoyed that we make so many line edits, they're like, no, like, I don't agree. And I think as a, like, especially as a staffer, I was like, who cares? But I'm like, oh, well, yeah. Like, you know, they can be gracious to a point, but at some point they're going to be like, this is still my writing and I know what I'm talking about. So I guess that, like, it just gave me more confidence to, like, want my own voice in something and to be, like, more firm about it.
Yeah, I like that, like, you all are drawing out both this, I guess, this dual reality of writing as a very communal process, and editing and like the legal world is this very communal process, and this feeling of confidence and empowerment that comes with the process of writing a note. The note writing process I think is presented often as like a pretty singular activity. Like you will take this idea from brainstorming to fruition and then you'll publish it. And as I like collaboration, so I guess maybe that's my bias showing, but it's nice to have exposed to folks that it's actually, at the end of the day, it is a single person product, but the process of getting there is really iterative and like very communal. So that is, I guess, a bit more process oriented, or those questions were about the process. I want to go back to the kind of content of each of your notes, because they are really interesting and really quite diverse in terms of what you all are talking about in argument, and kind of notes as a piece of advocacy is an interesting idea, I think, as well, not just a piece of academic writing that goes into a journal, but a real practical tool that somebody might look at one day. So I'm curious if, in turn, each of you would mind talking about kind of your key argument, your key takeaway that you want a reader to get out of your piece, and then also like who that target audience is, and maybe how that target audience informed your writing process. It's a lot of compound. That's a compound question. So not the best. Not the best formatting of a question, but curious if you might talk about that. So Tyler, if you want to start.
Yeah. I guess the very short answer is I would say the lesson of my piece is to be skeptical of defendant class actions. and I think that has a few different audiences. Primarily, just given the nature of mine, it is state legislators who often have the ability to change these rules, or their state Supreme Courts. The way that these rules are promulgated, it kind of varies by state. But I quite literally do plan to send my note to some legislators in some of these states that I think are especially problematic, to just sort of lay out the case of why some of these especially draconian rules around defendant class actions are really bad. But also, I think it will, we'll see, but I actually think it could be helpful for both litigants and judges who are dealing with these cases. The structure of almost every note, I think, is to go through sort of the mechanics and the background information on your topic before sort of reaching a conclusion or sort of the advocacy side of the note. And when you write stuff like this, I think you often see cited in cases or certainly future law review articles, that portion of it, the sort of explanation of the mechanics of it, is often what gets cited because someone has sat down and just spent many, many, many hours thinking through like every possible thing that could happen with a particular topic. And for me, I think that's one thing that I bring to the table for the scholarship is just really thinking through line by line of how a defendant class action would operate in the real world and how it has operated. And so I think it's helpful for judges and litigants who are dealing with defendant class actions to just get their minds around how they operate and what are some of the problems. So that's like not exactly advocacy, but it's almost a manual for people who are trying to deal with this problem. I've talked to a lot of people about defendant class actions along the way, and I've had three or four different people who are dealing with this issue. I had to send them various drafts of my piece because they were dealing with a defendant class action and just had no understanding of it, and there's not much scholarship out there. And I think it will hopefully be helpful for people who are dealing with this issue. So I think a couple of different audiences then. It's like legislators and policymakers who can fix this problem, and then also litigants and judges who are dealing with it as they come up.
Do you want to go? I can go. I think the biggest takeaway from mine in like super general terms is tribal sovereignty is important. That's ultimately what I come down on, and it needs to be preserved. I go through, I start my argument really talking about threats to tribal sovereignty through federal courts. So this goes back to like a challenge in writing my note. I wrote most of it before Brackeen came down. So it was like, I had in my mind how Brackeen was going to go. And I'm like, we're going to be so like screwed. Like federal Indian law is going to be done. Like, what's going to happen to tribal sovereignty? That didn't happen. Yay. very good. But I did have to like rework some of the frameworks. And I mean, Brackeen is still like, leave some things open. That's not what my note's about. But it was interesting to like frame my note in this issue of banishment in the larger discussion of like what it means to preserve tribal sovereignty and tribal rights, while also taking into account individual tribal members' individual like civil rights. So yeah, it was a tricky issue, but ultimately tribal sovereignty is really important. So I'm hoping that I kind of hope everybody reads my note, like no matter in what position they're in. I think that it's really, I'm just gonna feel like I'm tooting my own horn.
No, go toot toot at everyone. Yeah,
read my note if you want to learn about federal Indian law. I think I lay it out really nicely. Just historical context and like it is specific to banishment and like how courts have addressed this banishment and like the Indian Civil Rights Act issue in particular and like that whole realm. But I think it does really talk about the general threats that have happened over the course of time to Native peoples in the United States. And I think that would be valuable for, yeah, like Tyler was saying, that stuff does get cited by courts or law review articles. I mean, I did a lot of work and a lot of different like legal sources and other sources. So I kind of hope a lot of people read this and just in general take something away from it and see like how important not only tribal sovereignty is, but how important knowing this, like the connection between in like tribal law and like tribal nations and the federal government and like state governments really are. Like it's this incredibly detailed and hard to parse out. So I hope people read it and take advantage of my work because I did it. I parsed a lot of it out for you, so use it.
Well, I think the crux of my note is that most MLMs are pyramid schemes and they should be held accountable and they're not. And that's the TLDR. But I wrote my note, it's aimed at policymakers and regulators to kind of point out both the obvious, which is something that many students specifically, I will say I cited a lot of student notes about MLMs in the last 5 years. A lot of us are interested in these, it turns out. And so they're like Tyler and Randall have both been talking about, you know, doing all of this like background stuff. I've read like 6 student notes where they all did that. And so it was like, that's not the interesting part of my note. The interesting part of my note is thinking about how to make policy that isn't just looking at the legal background, but is considering what it is that like the people in the MLMs actually want. And is the solution for MLMs not to exist? I think when I went into writing the piece, that would be what I would say. Like, yeah, they're bad, they're predatory, they're fraudulent, like they shouldn't exist anymore. But, you know, considering people's reasoning for joining them, it's like people want something like that to join. That's why so many people join them. And so to make laws that deal with that and the fact that they are predatory, you have to think about both. So I think my note is aimed mostly at policymakers to be kind of just say like, you need to think about both things in order to make good policy. And the other thing that I tried very hard to do was make my piece accessible to people outside of the legal community. So I would love for people to read my note who don't attend a law school, are not a professor, aren't lawyers, because I think that it's important for people to just be able to read about things and it doesn't just live in obscurity in a law review. Because I think people think MLMs are fascinating and they're like, haha, aren't they pyramid schemes? I don't know. And then they move on. But I would love for someone to read my piece and be like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Like, now I understand it better. Or now I really think that someone should do something about this. And so my audience that I was thinking about was obviously legal minds thinking about how to solve this issue, but also just people who might be interested in the topic and making sure it's useful for both of those groups.
like it should pop up as suggested reading after someone watches the Hulu documentary on MLMs.
Correct. Yes. After the LuLaRoe documentary wraps, a little pop-up should come up and be like, learn more. Go read this 55-page note. Everyone will do it, I think. They'll love it.
I just, before we move on to my next question, I just want to give a little shout out and appreciation. I mean, I think that you all took such care with your notes, and that really came through in how you're talking about them, in the reading that I've done. And I feel like it's such a special opportunity to have you all here talking with one another and talking about your process, because it really just goes to show that, you know, these notes, as with the articles we publish, as with articles that are published across many legal law reviews and journals, are like labors of love, and really are like important for scholarship and important for advocacy. That kind of takes us into my next question, which is, you know, you all have talked about, as students writing these notes, that you hope people read them, that you hope they inform policy decisions. And I'm curious to hear maybe a bit more generally your take on the role of student scholarship in legal academia. We have, I think, 15 notes being published by student authors, and it's common among law reviews to publish and amplify student works, and that feels very exciting to me. I'm curious if it feels exciting to you all and why it feels exciting, if so. Yeah, I just showed my hand there. So again, not a great interview question, but yeah, it feels important. So
I keep wanting to make jokes about like objecting at a trial. It's just like, my brain has been smoothed to just be like legal jokes. And that is so heinous.
It's the three LOL.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I do think it's important. It's not really something I thought about prior to coming to law school. I think for students, I think students can have a surprising, maybe not surprising, but I think there's a creativity to student notes that I'm not saying professors aren't creative, but I think when you're first starting out and you're like really amped that you get this opportunity, and, you know, the three of us, I think, clearly were pretty amped to write our pieces. But you can do anything. And I think if you really lean into that, students can talk about really interesting things that people in the legal academic world are not thinking about. So that's an amazing opportunity. And I think that actually, like, should be like a signal to people who are in the legal academic world, like, here's a new idea for you to be thinking about, even if that student never writes about it again. So I think that's an amazing opportunity. And I think we've all talked about how it gave us confidence in our writing and in our, like, I've seen other student note authors talk about the confidence it gave them to be an academic, quote unquote, to feel like they can contribute to legal scholarship, and that it's not just like some far off idea, that you really could do it, and here's your opportunity to like try it out and see what it's like. So yeah, I mean, it is kind of wild that I am not barred, but someone let me write a 55-page paper on this topic that I'm obsessed with.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, two sort of things come to mind. Like, one is that it sort of selfishly, right, it is a really good platform for you to be able to launch a legal career on, right? There is an expectation, at least among some attorneys, for you to publish things like this throughout your career. And I think it would be difficult to go from 0 to 60 really quickly without having done this first. And so now, just looking forward, I think it will be easier to write the next thing, given that I've gone through this really intense process for the note. And you know, the thing itself can be really helpful too, which is my second point, is that I think sometimes, you know, I've worked with a lot of attorneys out in the field who have been out of law school for a very long time, and trying to say this delicately, but you know, they are thinking about they went through law school and they learned the law as it was when they were in law school. And I think it's helpful to have just a constant churn of new students who are seeing the law fresh as it has developed over the years and come up with new ideas, right? The classic example of someone who wrote a student note and sort of launched a career on this is Lena Khan, right? She wrote about antitrust when she was a student, and she like sort of saw a problem that from her perspective of a student, and that and now she's the FTC chair, right? I mean, we can't all be Lena Khan, but I think that we
no
can.
One, the rest of us are never going to be Lena Khan.
But I think that we are a little bit closer to modern problems, and we have that perspective that people who have been out of law school start to lose as time goes on. And so I think, and Lindsay sort of talked about this as well, but that I think is powerful too. We're able to have all this fresh energy about the law and also connect that with a problem that we see out in the world that's important to us.
Yeah, I don't have a ton to add, and I would echo what both of you guys just said. I think specifically going back what Lindsay said about creativity, I think that that really has a lot of value in student notes. I mean, law school in general is not, this is just my like view on it, it's not a super creative place to be. There, it's very like kind of cut and dry, like you learn X, Y, and Z, you prepare for the bar. You can make it more creative if you want to. And one of those ways is like through a note to like, this goes back to the first question I think we were talking about is like finding something that you're interested in or you're passionate about and like writing something that can contribute to legal scholarship. I mean, I hope a lot of people read our notes, and I think they will. They should. But like, even if nobody does, like, we still put something out there that's in legal academia. It's in legal scholarship, and like, not everybody can do that. So I think that that's really valuable. And on a personal level, and then yeah, if people read it on a more widespread level, because I mean, people come up with new note ideas based off of what old note ideas are, like what we'll write about next year. Some people might be like, I disagreed and I'm going to write this note that's like completely different from what you had, or like support it in a different like time and context. So I think it's, yeah, it's important for like the evolving scholarship door. Yeah. Revolving.
I mean, I think people do read student notes quite
people,
a lot. I mean,
no, people yeah. do. Yeah, I mean, I'm just like, even if nobody
yeah,
does,
yeah.
people, but people
I,
will.
I think I didn't quite understand that too, but Lindsay mentioned this earlier, like, she read a lot of student notes in preparation, for, and I did as well. There's not a ton of scholarship out there on the medical section, but a couple of student notes have already been written on this topic, and I think that was pleasantly surprising to me. I think that the student notes are right there in with the rest of the scholarship on being cited in future law review articles. So, like, I don't know, it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, I had that experience as well. Especially if you're writing about a particularly timely topic or an area of law that is kind of under-theorized or underwritten about, you may be relying on student notes. You may be relying on alternative, like non-legal scholarship as well. And in turn, what you contribute is like a part of a pretty small pie, but growing. And so that's really exciting. So I want to close out with just kind of like one more question. You know, Randa, you said that this may not be your practice area, but was obviously super interesting to dive into. Tyler said at the top that you are a civil baddie. So like, you know, I know that this is an area of like professional interest for you. And, you know, Lindsay, you came at this note from an excitement and enthusiasm that is like overlapping with areas of professional interest. And I'm curious if you all can close out with thoughts on how you think your note has kind of informed your law school experience, but maybe also your next steps and how you will approach legal problems in the future. Yeah. Some closing wisdom for us.
I can start with the closing wisdom in whatever capacity I can contribute to it. I think it goes back to what I said. I was able to learn about an area, a specific subset of an area that I knew nothing about. And I think that that's really helped my law school experience, because there's no way I would have ever learned about this if it wasn't for the note writing process. Like, I don't know when I would have come across banishment in like among tribal members without it. And I will say I'm always going to be interested in federal Indian law and tribal law, and maybe that will be my career path. And I'll be able to come at
come at it with the knowledge and like all of the scholarship that I reviewed for my note, kind of incorporate that in there. But even if I do something completely different, I think the note writing process just allows you to be a better writer, allows you to formulate your thoughts in like kind of a more cohesive way. I mean, I'm a babbler and that's going to come across in this podcast and it's how I write too. But the note writing process really helped me hone in on like those practical skills. And then, yeah, just the general editing process is super helpful moving forward, allows you to communicate with a lot of different people who like might not know the contents of your note at all. They might know. But it, I don't know. It just gave me a lot of confidence moving into like whatever practice area that I go into, whether it's federal Indian law or not.
Again, I think for me, it's two things. One is the process and then the other is the substance, right? It's like Randa said, I think the just what I learned going through this process was extremely helpful for me. Honestly, the biggest thing for me was like how to accept feedback, which is like something that I constantly need to work on. And that alone was, I think, really helpful. Just thinking about how to write and trusting that other people will be able to help me in that process and not like have like embarrassment that I'm putting forward half-baked ideas and like just let people react naturally to those things. So I think that is helpful. The other is the substance, though, right? I mean, I think you were going to be kind of a subject matter expert on whatever it is you write, probably for the rest of your career, right? Anyone who's, you know, if Lindsay is working in some sort of consumer protection place and they're talking about MLMs, they're definitely going to go talk to her. Like, oh, hey, I know you wrote about this thing, right? If Randa's, if certainly banishment ever comes up, right? Like,
Randa's your girl, right?
So, you know, and that I'm certain if defendant class actions come up in the future that people will probably come to me about those kind of things as well. So, you know, it is that opportunity, I think, to just pick a very narrow thing and really just master that and become a subject matter expert there as well.
Yeah. So I think in terms of my law school experience, I think my law school experience has really probably, again, not uniquely, but gone from like, I know what I'm doing to like, I literally have no idea what I'm doing to like, oh, maybe I kind of know to like, oh, I really, really don't know. And now I'm sort of leveling out at like, okay, yeah, you learned a lot, but you know, like you can never know the entirety of the law. And that's just like, is what it is. And a lot of the note writing process was like in the lowest dip of like, you have no idea what you're doing. And so I think for my law school experience, at the end of it all, it is like you have to always like, this is gonna sound so corny, sorry everyone, it's true, you have to like believe in yourself to be able to do some of this stuff. And a lot of people are gonna believe in you and help you and push you to like do what they think you can do, but at the end of the day, like to be able to do some of this stuff, like you just have to keep going. You have to be like, this note's gonna be good and I can do this. And like broadly for me, that was like, you can do law school, you can be a lawyer, you can like do the things you want to do. So certainly I did not like the writing process for many reasons, but it helped me a lot. Like here now I am at like 3 months out from graduation, 2 months. I'm not keeping track. I know other people are. Yeah, I think... Do I have wisdom about what it, I mean, it was definitely, it's like it affirmed for me that I'm interested in economic justice issues and that's what I'm doing after law school too. So, you know, that was great. And I don't think that's everyone's experience with note writing. I know plenty of people who are like, I actually like definitively don't want to do something now that I've written a note about it. But I think that's also kind of great. To be like, I'm a student, I spent a lot of time learning about something, and it turns out it's probably good I didn't choose that for my career because I think it's boring or I don't like it. So, yeah, I mean, I have been, it was formative, is like the really short version of that for me. But, yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you all. I What a treat to get to chat with you all about your notes and to learn a little bit more about the substantive legal issues, but also a little bit more about the writing process and some of the meta questions that come along with being a published author. If you're listening to this, you should definitely check out these pieces. They're available on the Minnesota Law Review website, and that, along with all the other scholarship we publish, is ready and able to be consumed. So thanks again for being here, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.